Anybody want to tell us what anything about Philippi? What do we know about Philippi? This is, we're in the first, the latter part of the first chapter of Philippians and starting into the second chapter. Small book, four chapters, so we'll get through this pretty quickly, but interesting study. Paul visited Philippi. Paul visited Philippi around 49 or 50 A.D. And if you recall, on his second missionary journey, they ended up in the city of Troas. Paul and Silas and Timothy, Luke, we believe, is there as well. But they ended up in Troas, and if you'll recall, Paul had a night vision, and this man from Macedonia said, "Come and help us, come over here." And so Paul was very eager to get to Philippi. First time that he, at least as we have recorded, first time that he had been in Europe for actual missionary work. And he went to Philippi just as quick as he possibly could. And Philippi, as we remember, was a very ancient city. It was a gold mining city, and you could see, when the gold miners wandered around in this western part of the United States, they tore the dickens out of the landscape, and they were rough towns and lots of violence and that type of thing. But it was an ancient city. It was located in northeastern Greece, faced a plain, and down from the plain there was the sea. There was a main road that came through there from Europe to Asia, a main trading route, and Philippi set on that trade route. There was not a little village, somewhere around 100,000, give or take a few. It was quite a populous city. We read about the second missionary journey and Paul visiting Philippi in Acts, the 16th chapter. And apparently, even though the city was quite a large city, there wasn't any synagogue there. So there was not very many Jewish people that lived in Philippi. And I think that according to Jewish tradition and stuff, and all the things that they had to do in the synagogue, had to be at least 10 men. So apparently they didn't have 10 men there in Philippi, and so there wasn't a synagogue. And because of this, Paul and his group, after spending several days there in Philippi, they went out on the riverbank to worship. And who did they run into out there? Anybody remember?
Lydia.
I'm sorry?
Lydia?
Yeah, a lady named Lydia. Not sure that she was Jewish. Some people say they think she was a converted Gentile, proselyte, but regardless, she was worshiping there. That she went out there with a bunch of women, which happened to be a pretty common practice. And she heard Paul, and God opened her heart, and she was converted, and she took Paul and his party to her home, and she was baptized along with her household. Lydia was from a town in what modern day Turkey now, in east of western part of Asia, and from a city called Thyatira. And about the only mention I find of Thyatira is in Revelation 20. But there was a church there. Who set that church up, we don't know. We're not told where. But anyway, Paul baptized her. And then as they spent several days there in Philippi, Paul is going through the city, and the slave girl comes up. And she has an evil spirit. And she is promoting Paul, what fine fellow he was, and all the things that he could do. And of course, it irritated Paul. And so he turned around and told the spirit to depart from the slave girl. Well, that's what happened. The problem was, and it wasn't the first time that Paul had gotten into trouble over the very same thing, the men that had the slave girl were making money because she was prophesying the future and all that good stuff, and so it made them mad because they lost their profit. She could no longer do that, so it cost them their living. So what happens? They haul Paul and his group in before the magistrates, and they get beat up and thrown in jail. Must have been considered pretty serious because they stuck them down in the inner part of the jail, put them in stocks and everything like this, so they were pretty secure. But around midnight, how many of us get up at midnight and sing and worship the Lord at midnight? Of course, I don't think at least any of us have been in prison, but here Paul and his group are bound up, and they're at midnight, and they're singing praises, singing hymns to God. And there comes an earthquake, and all their stocks are loosened. The jail doors are opened, and the Philippian jailer we know about, he was the one that was going to fall on a sword. But Paul encouraged him and said, "No, we're all here. Don't do that." So the jailer became converted, and he took Paul and his group home and washed their stripes, cleaned them up, fed them, and then he was baptized along with his household. And so there is the beginning of the Philippian church as we need it, as we know it. Lydia and her family, her household, now the Philippian jailer and his household. So it's the beginning of a congregation there. Philippians is interesting because there's no mention of any major problems there. There was problems of some type. Paul, unfortunately, always had someone coming along behind him, repudiating his words, his teaching, out of jealousy. Most of them that are mentioned are Jews, so they follow along. Of course, the Jews are just so embedded in the Jewish religion and the traditions and that type of thing. They had a bunch of Jews that kept following Paul from town to town and causing problems. And I think this is what happened in here, that they just kept coming around. Each chapter of this book, and I think I mentioned this, is really just full of compassion and love. Paul had a special place in his heart for these people. And it shows. There's not any quotes in the four chapters of Philippians. There's not any quotes from the Old Testament. Why do you suppose that is? Anybody have any ideas?
Well, it doesn't make any sense if they're not Jews. They don't know. The Gentiles don't know.
Okay.
So, the Gentiles aren't familiar with the Old Testament.
There you go. Okay. This is a Gentile city, isn't it? Not very many Jews there. And so Paul is teaching a group of Gentiles. So they don't need the Old Testament hung around their neck, and the circumcision and all that stuff that the Jews promoted. So there's no reason why Paul needs to even mention the Old Testament. Okay. But Christ in the four chapters is mentioned over 40 times. And so this is where Paul concentrates. This is where he needs to concentrate his teaching. And we know from secular history that Paul wrote this about 60 to 62 AD, right in that neighborhood. The reason we know this is because certain members of the city council, the ruling council in Philippi, also the emperor at that particular time, is mentioned in Paul's letters, and mentioned also in secular history. So we can pretty well pinpoint it down to a couple of years. Paul wrote this while he was in prison. He never spent any time feeling sorry for himself. He was always busy promoting the Lord. So, in the first 11 verses of Philippians chapter 1, Paul's saying a prayer. And he's thanking the Philippians for all the support and their partnership that they provided for him from day one. And they sent messengers. We'll find out a guy's name, Epaphroditus, who was apparently a member of one of the families there in Philippi. And he was sent, member of the church, he was sent on several journeys to provide support for Paul and as he was going around. So the Philippians kept a close watch on Paul. And they loved him so much, they provided support for him the whole time that he was gone. It's about 10 years. And so he has a special feeling for these people. And they were willing to not only support him while he was in prison, but they also had a willingness to defend the gospel. And even though Paul was a long ways away, he was in Rome and in prison. From time to time he was locked up, but sometimes he had his own house, and he was able to see people, and he was able to wander around close by. But he was still considered a prisoner. And even though he was a long ways away in Rome, these people still... there was a risk in supporting someone in prison. And support for preaching the gospel. And not like the freedom that we have today. We pretty much meet whenever we want. We don't have too much to worry about as far as the government control on our worshiping. And this is not the case back in those days. People were at risk. But Paul prays for that their love, even as much as it is, may improve more and more. But with knowledge and discernment and being pure and holy when Christ comes, with knowledge, their love may improve more and more. And Paul puts a parameter on it. He says, with knowledge. What does that mean? Anybody have any idea? Paul says, increase your love, improve your love with knowledge.
Understanding.
Okay, study. Okay? Study God's word. Improve yourself with knowledge. But it also says discerning. Okay, well, that falls right in there with the understanding, doesn't it? Let's go ahead and read. Somebody want to read? Let's see if we can get somebody. John? Okay. Verses, chapter 1, verse 12 through 18.
Chapter 1, verses 12 through 18.
Yeah.
Reading from the New King James Version.
Okay.
Well, but I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel, so that it has become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest that my chains are in Christ. And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ, even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains, but the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached. In this I rejoice, yes, and will rejoice.
Okay. Thank you, John. Paul is saying here that, yes, I'm in prison. I'm in a strange city. But what has happened to me has really been an advantage. It's really served to advance the gospel. He has the freedom and the opportunity. We remember a man named Onesimus who came to Paul. I think it was on purpose, but said actually, you know, maybe it was an accident, but anyway, Paul converted Onesimus, who was a runaway slave. But he had other opportunities as well. And one of the things that he speaks of is the Praetorian Guard. These people were special military people. They were handpicked to guard the palace and all the royalty that was in it. And Paul has, of course, a Praetorian guard that works with him, or several, that is kind of keeps an eye on him. And he says, you know, I'm doing okay. Even though I'm in prison, I'm not going to lose an opportunity to preach the gospel to each and every person. And now he has the Praetorian guards. Now, the reason why we know this is that Paul mentions the Praetorian guards send greetings to the church in Philippi. But, says Paul, I still got people that are ragging me, even here in Rome. He said, I've got enemies, and some of them preach the gospel out of envy, out of pretense. But and there's people that go around and preach the gospel that are honest, sincere. And they're proclaiming God. But he says, either way, even though not all of them are for me, either way, whether they preach out of jealousy, envy, or out of sincerity, it's still a plus. The word of God still gets out there. And so he is rejoicing in that. Let's read chapter 1. 19. Yes, go ahead.
Doesn't it seem kind of odd, or and even backwards, that he writes that there some people have more courage to preach the gospel because I'm in prison? I mean, if your best friend's in prison, is that going to make you want to run out and pump up that whatever he's preaching?
Yeah, you know, and of course we have to put ourselves in the circumstances that they're in back in those days. But they're looking at Paul, and they're seeing him, well, you know, this guy's in prison. He doesn't know from day to day whether or not he's going to even live or not. Paul speaks an encouraging word about, well, I really expect to see you again. But I don't know. But regardless of whether he is worried, or you know, whether or not he's going to be executed or released, he's out there working just as hard as ever, isn't he? And it's encouraging to others. It encourages them to get out. Yes, John?
It immediately came to mind was Luke 9:49-50, Master said, John, we saw someone driving out demons in your name. We tried to stop him because he does not accompany us. And Jesus said, do not stop him. Jesus replied, whoever is not against you is for you.
Okay. Excellent point. Thank you, John. Bob, appreciate your comments as well. Let's read 19 through 26. Somebody handy there that has that? Okay, thank you, Kellen. So, sorry, Linda. So you see here that Paul has expectations to be set free. But he's saying also, I'm not sure, but either way is a gain for me and a gain for him. He says, I long to be with Christ. He said, I would much rather be executed and live with Christ than continue on in this physical world. But, he said, regardless, if I continue on and live in this world, then it's going to be a gain for me too. Because I can come and see you, I can encourage you, I can teach others. And he said that he can continue in their progress and their joy in the faith. But he is. He's torn between two things. If he lives, it'll be for Christ and fruitful labor. But if he dies, it would be his gain and actually his desire to be with Christ. And he says that that is far better. So let's read 1:27 to chapter 2:2. 1:27 to 2:2. Anybody want to do that? Okay, go ahead, Jerry.
Go ahead. Sorry. When we conduct ourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether in tongue and to you and remain absent, having here of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. In no way alarmed by your opponents, which is a sign of destruction from them, for them, but a salvation for you, and that too from God. For to you it has been granted for Christ's sake not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. Experiencing the same conflict which you saw in me and now hear to be in me. If there is any encouragement in Christ, if there is any consolation of love, if there is any fellowship in the Spirit, if any affliction of compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in Spirit, intent on one
purpose. Thank you, Jan. Here's Paul writing then, if I come to see you in the flesh, or I'm absent, be sure and stand firm with one spirit, one mind, not fearing your opponents or your enemies. If you do that, it will be to their destruction, but for your salvation. But he says you are going to suffer for Christ's sake. And then he says again, so be of one mind, one spirit, one love, the same accord, and complete my joy. So this is, Paul has just mentioned this, he kind of gets into it a little bit. And we'll find out when we get into chapter 4, a couple of ladies who were strong in the faith, but apparently they had differences of opinion. And so there's just kind of a minor conflict. Paul doesn't dwell on it a whole lot, but he has heard of it. And I'm sure Epaphroditus has filled him in completely on what's going on here, as he has been traveling back and forth, supplying Paul with support. Let's read chapter 2, verse 3 to 12. Who wants to do that? Yeah, that's fine, right there. Okay, Paul is saying, okay, you need to be unselfish. Okay, don't be conceitful. Don't have any conceit in your body. But it says be humble, but count others more important and better than yourselves. But he says also, don't ignore yourself. Okay? Look after yourselves, he says, but also look out after others. How often do we do that? And it's very satisfying to me, and has been over the years, to worship with this congregation. We're a group of fine, fine Christian people. And we're people that are eager to help others. Anytime we have a word that someone is in need, there's just countless people step up wanting to know what they can do to help others. And you see this from week to week, from day to day. We have a one-call system where we notify the congregation if there's anybody in need, or there's some vital news that comes about, whether someone needs our prayers, whatever like that, physical needs, you know. We have the one-call system so we can get the word out to everybody regardless of when and where the time is. We also, to back that one-call up, we also have the internet, and Dean usually puts out an email telling everybody basically the same thing. I know that some people don't have access to email, so we do have that one call, and it gets out to everybody. But it is. We have all of us have our own personal problems, one type or another. And whatever they might be, we seem to be eager to reach out and offer our help to others. And that's one of the greatest pluses, in this group of people. We like to be friendly. We like to invite everybody to come back whenever they can. It's just, you know, we're just an eager bunch of solid Christians that want to do the best we can for others. In this verse that Eileen just read, you know, Paul gives us a perfect example. And he talks about Christ being the perfect example. He was in heaven with God. He humbled himself to come to this earth, lived as an earthly being, suffered all the same things that you and I suffer. And yet he humbled himself to the point even unto death. He could call 10,000 angels to defend him, but he allowed himself to be humbled and hung on a cross. Well, we know the story of that, don't we? But the one most wonderful thing of all is that he did this for us. He made intercession for us so that we might have that opportunity of being with God in the hereafter. So Paul is saying, so beloved, even though I might be absent from you, work out your own salvation with fear and with trembling. God is at work within you.
Hold on a minute here.
Go.
We're not saved by work. That's what our Baptist friends and others tell us.
Yeah.
We're not saved by works. Mm-hmm. But yet we're told right here to work out our own salvation.
Ephesians 2, verse 8 and 9. Says faith, not works. Do we have conflict here? One place tells us faith and not works. The next thing we're told is work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Yes, Jay.
Doesn't James tell us that faith without works is a dead faith?
Okay. James 2. That's right. Eileen, did you have a comment?
It's that works, you have to pay for how does that go?
Okay.
Is that, are they both the same meaning, the same word? I don't know.
Okay. Yes, Bob.
Well, I think the whole point of the thing is that we're told that we have to be active. If you want to call it being work, doing works, okay, or if you don't want to call it that, we have to be active doing whatever we're doing, and that shows our faith. That activity is a way of showing our faith, and that's the faith that saves us.
Okay.
The active faith.
Okay, I think that this is a real great spot to hold up and give you an opportunity to spend a little bit of time studying this. Take a look in James, as Jane mentioned. Study James, take a look in Ephesians, second chapter. Read a little bit about that. And then we will pick it up here next week and we'll talk about this very thing. So you can get lots of ammunition there's lots of information out there. So this would be a good place. I even have James 2, 14 through 17, and James 2, 18 through 26. And then I have in parentheses, discuss this. So we'll stop there and we'll plan on discussing this a little bit next Sunday morning, Lord's willing. You know, it's one of the, kind of a side note. In studying for my lesson, there are lots of scholars, I'm trying to put that in quotation marks, that talk about the book of Philippians. And they argue back and forth on, well, we think, or I think it's a group of fragments of several of Paul's letters grouped together as one. And because there is a kind of a change of pace there a couple of times. And some say, well, no. Well, was it written in Rome? It could have been written in Ephesus, but we have no record of Paul being in jail there. But he was in jail in Caesarea. So he could have wrote that from Caesarea as well. It's a lot closer than Rome to Philippi, and so that seemed reasonable to me. And they had palace guards there too, because that was where Pilate and Herod was from time to time. So, they just missed the point. They're so busy arguing about, well, whether this was written here, whether that was written there, when was it written? Was it written really in 60 to 62 A.D., or was it written some other time? Epaphroditus, if he was traveling overland, he couldn't make it in that two-year period between Paul and when this letter, when this letter was written. So, I mean, they just missed the entire point, and they're bugging over minor issues. What do we care where Paul wrote the letter? It's okay. If he wrote it in Caesarea or Ephesus, I don't care. Fact is, I have Philippians in front of me that I can study and learn from. But they missed the entire point. They spent all their professional careers arguing with one another about when it was written, where, how many pieces were punched together. I don't know. So that's something to think about too next week. But thank you so much for your comments. Appreciate them very, very much. And we will start next week on James 2. And we'll discuss this faith and faith without works.